If you have your Bible, please turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 8. We are continuing here in our study of the book of 2 Corinthians, just kind of going along verse by verse and looking at what we have here from the Word of God. Most of us have probably had the rather embarrassing experience of receiving a late payment notification. We have agreed to buy something, maybe on credit or in some way, and we said that we would buy something, we took it home, and then all of a sudden we kind of forgot about it, and time went on, and we get a little note in the mail or some kind of a notification saying, you agreed to pay for this and you haven't paid for it yet. Occasionally we get those notifications at home, maybe we get them at church, maybe in your business or whatever, we get a notification that you have agreed to pay for something and yet you haven't done so yet. The bill is due and you haven't paid it. Maybe you're overdue. And so you're a little bit embarrassed about that, and you usually kind of scramble around to try to, okay, pay this bill and make sure it's out of the way, and you don't want to have a, you know, a bad reflection on your credit rating or whatever for failing to pay off your bills and things. Well, in the book of 2 Corinthians, as we're going through chapters 8 and 9, Paul is talking about an offering that he is trying to collect and prepare for the poor saints at Jerusalem. Some really terrible circumstances had occurred there in Jerusalem. These people are suffering poverty, if not starvation. And Paul knew that the churches elsewhere were doing better. And so he's trying to collect this offering. And they had agreed there in Corinth, the believers at Corinth had agreed to participate in this offering. In fact, they had been very enthusiastic about it. But as of yet, they had not sent in the money. You might say that they were late in making their payment. And so Paul basically is saying in this passage that he's getting ready, or actually has already sent some people to collect the offering. In fact, it appears as if the men that Paul mentions here are the ones who carried his letter from where he was, probably in Macedonia somewhere, over to Achaia, which is where Corinth is. So these men had come with this letter that we're reading, and Paul now is trying to endorse these men as reliable, honest, trustworthy people whom the Corinthians could trust with their money. They're about to give these men a good chunk of money, and the Corinthian people needed to have a favorable impression of these men. They needed to know that these men were reliable and trustworthy if they were going to give them this amount of money for them to carry back to Jerusalem to help out with these poor saints in Jerusalem. So these virtues that we see in the men that Paul is commending here, the men who are going to collect this offering, these are the same kind of virtues that we should have in our lives as well. I see these men as somewhat exemplary, as men who are honest and trustworthy and reliable, people that we can trust to do a job like this. And so the question as we approach the text is, am I the kind of person who has these virtues? Or am I the kind of person that someone would entrust with this kind of a job, this kind of a project? Would someone think of me or think of you when thinking about a project that requires a great deal of honesty and reliability and trustworthiness? Let's say I need a trustworthy person, a person who's reliable, a person whom can handle money without any question or accusation, a person that we know is absolutely honest and reliable. Now, who can I get to do that job? Who comes to your mind? Well, all of us, any one of us, ought to be able to be trusted with that kind of a job. Now, whether we could do it or not, you know, this would take several months to travel down to Corinth and collect this money and travel back to Jerusalem. This is a long-term project. But it only can be done by people that are honest and reliable and trustworthy. The kind of virtues that are mentioned here are true of these men, the men that Paul is trying to commend and encourage the people at Corinth to trust. And we ought to have these same virtues as well. Well, we started this passage before Easter. And we looked at three of these necessary virtues already. We talked about diligence. We talked about being approved or recognized by the church. And then we talked about having faithful administration. And so the church needs people like this to serve in whatever capacities, you know, are going on around here. We need people who have these kind of qualities, these kind of virtues, to be involved in participating in serving the Lord through the ministry of the church. Well, we'll look at two more of these qualities then that are necessary for people who want to serve. The fourth one in our list here is found in verses 20 and 21, honest financial operations. So here we have verses 20 and 21. Avoiding this, that anyone should blame us in this lavish gift which is administered by us, providing honorable things, not only in the sight of the Lord, but also in the sight of men. So we're talking here about honest financial operations. Now, in the course of the last several weeks, I think I've mentioned several really sad situations in various churches where we know of really deceitful and wrong financial abuse, really, in some of these churches. These things have come up in the news. The pastors and people associated have been put in jail, or they've been made the subject of very, very serious accusations. And so we don't have to look around far to see that within churches, it's very sadly true that oftentimes there is financial mismanagement. There are people who, if they have their hands on money, they will try to use that money for themselves. In fact, among the 12 disciples, was there one individual who was guilty of financial mismanagement? Judas held the bag. He held the purse. And it says he used that money for himself. Well, it's not unusual. It's not infrequent. It's not uncommon, unfortunately, in some situations, in some religious places and churches even, that we have people who are not reliable. They are dishonest. They'll use that money, if they can get their hands on it, for their own purposes. And so Paul is saying here, the men that I'm sending to you, who have actually brought this letter to you, these are reliable men. These are not people who are open to accusation. These are people that you can trust with this offering. Well, Paul wanted to avoid any accusation of financial mismanagement or fraud. He knew that he had to be very careful about this because, as would be just normally understood, as would be naturally understood, if you're going to be giving a sizable amount of money to somebody to care for and to transport, it's not as if you could hire, who are those people who run around in the armored trucks? You know, you can't hire, yeah, Brinks man or something. Call the Brinks man to come over and give him the money, and it's secure and it's in an armored truck and take it a couple hundred miles. Well, I don't think they had Brinks trucks back at this time. These are just people who would be traveling with this money, and so these needed to be reliable and honorable people. So how do we today maintain a high degree of financial integrity when we're talking about the finances of the church? Now, you know, we're a small church. We don't generate a huge amount of income or money, but still we have to be very careful with the financial dealings of the church. So how do we do that? What are some ways that we can make sure that we are dealing in financial integrity? Well, I think in the text itself, there are reflected a couple of principles, three or four here. Verse 20, notice he says, avoiding this, that anyone should blame us in this lavish gift. The word blame here means literally a blemish, a stain, a fault, a criticism, or something discrediting. So we can avoid the kind of blameworthy behavior that would lead to somebody making an accusation against us. We have to avoid blameworthy behavior. He didn't want there to be any accusations of financial mismanagement. He didn't want anybody making allegations against them as if they were using this money for themselves. And it appears that this offering was rather substantial. He calls it a lavish gift. The word lavish means large or abundant or plentiful. So this was a sizable amount of money. I don't know if it was in gold coin. I don't think at this time they really had paper money, did they? I think everything was in gold or silver, or I don't know if they had, I guess they had copper coins at this time. But probably hauling a large amount of money would have been a significant thing. I don't know if they had it in money bags or if they had it in a box or something, but clearly if this was a lavish gift, it was probably a sizable amount of money. And remember, it was collected from several churches. The church there in Corinth, that was a rather prosperous church. So they could be expected to give a large amount of money. The churches up in Macedonia had contributed, about they're 200 miles north of there. So they're collecting all this money, and they need reliable people to secure this money as they transport it from one place to another. Well, whenever we're handling other people's money, and especially that money that is given for the work of the Lord, we need to be especially careful and cautious. I think all of us want the church to handle the funds that we give to the church in our offerings we want that money to be handled very carefully and cautiously. We don't want people spending it in places that it shouldn't be spent. We don't want people using it for their own personal advantage. We expect that money to be cared for. And we expect the church to be transparent and honest in reporting about how we use the money that the people give. Sometimes when people are praying, like they pray for the offering, they pray that it would be used for the proper purposes. Well, that's what we want. That's what we expect. If we're giving money for the use of the church and for the missionaries, we expect that money to be used in the ministry of the church for the necessary purposes of the Great Commission and for that money to get to the missionaries. Maybe you give especially for the missionaries, or you designate your offerings for a certain thing. That's fine, and we want to make sure that the money that's given is given for those purposes. So that's required then, that we are careful with the use and the handling, the transporting of the funds that are given. It's important to avoid the kind of behavior that anyone would see as faulty or fraudulent. We need to avoid even the appearance of evil. Years ago, before I came here, I was at a church south of here, and at that church was a family. One of the several family members of that church belonged to the family in town that owned the bank. So what usually happened was these people, these adult women who were part of our church, they worked at the bank, and so generally after the offering was taken, that offering was just given to one lady in particular, and since she worked at the bank, she would just go to the bank and deposit the money. I guess the assumption was she would deposit the money on Monday after the collection on Sunday. Well, I came to find out that oftentimes the people who collected the ushers would give the money to this lady. She would put it, essentially just slip it into her book bag. She had one of these kind of tote bags. She would put it down there, and then she'd kind of forget about it. And so it might be a week or two or three before she got around to making the deposit. So we're not talking thousands of dollars. This was a small church, maybe $300 to $400, $500 in the collection every week. But still, that money would be rattling around at the bottom of her book bag as she went from place to place. She had children. She was traveling all over. She did lots of things in the community. And that money, several hundred dollars, would be down in the bottom of her book bag before she got around to depositing it. Well, I heard about that, and I said, we're not going to do that anymore. Not only is that money insecure the whole time it's in just in your bag down there, but it's really a poor testimony. And if anybody made an accusation, well, how could she defend herself? If somebody said, oh, you took the offering money and you used it for a car payment, it would just be her word. So that's not a very secure way to deal with money. And obviously, we expect a little bit more than that. And I'm not saying that she was ever guilty of any kind of financial fraud or if you call that mismanagement, I guess maybe. But I don't think anybody ever accused her of using that money for herself. But you could see how, for her, she thought it's no big deal. She works at the bank. She's working with money all the time. And for her just to have that money rattling around in the bottom of her bag, she didn't see that as a big problem. But I did. And so we tried to take care of that and make that practice end. Well, that's the kind of financial mismanagement, any kind of fraud or any kind of abuse or any kind of accusation Paul didn't want to have regarding this offering. Somebody said that money matters are notorious for generating trouble in marriages, businesses, and even in churches. Churches and Christian ministries must be above reproach in all aspects of their operation, in order that one should not be able to discredit them. We have, as I mentioned, our quarterly business meeting coming up next Sunday, and as part of that meeting, we'll give a report on the money that came in and how we spent it or how we sent it out, whatever we did with that. We want to be honest, we want to be transparent, and any member of the church who wants to see the books can see how the money came in and how it went out and what we're doing with it and where it's at and everything down to the penny. So we have to be very careful in those regards. So we want to avoid the kind of behavior that would lead to any kind of accusation of fraud or abuse. Secondly, we want to involve multiple people in this project. Now, if we go back to verse 16, Paul mentions Titus. Thanks be to God who puts the same earnest care for you into the heart of Titus. Titus is one of the colleagues of Paul that he's sending on this project. He mentions Titus, and then in verse 18, we have sent with him the brother, whose praise is in the gospel. I think I mentioned that probably is Luke, or a lot of people think that is Luke. And then he mentions one other person in verse 22. We have sent with them our brother, whom we have often proved diligent in many things. So here's somebody else, another unnamed individual that perhaps the church at Corinth knows. Obviously, these men have now showed up at Corinth, so they know who these guys are. But there's at least three people now who are involved in this offering. However, if we consider what the other passages in the Bible says, we can go to the book of Acts where he describes this thing as well. It looks like there's at least seven people who are involved in the collection and the transportation of this money from Greece back to Jerusalem. So involvement of these many men would ensure that the money is handled properly and securely. There's usually better accountability when multiple people are responsible. When dealing with money, you usually don't want to just have one person who is handling the money. You want to have at least two or more. When when the church counts the money from the offerings, there's two people who count that money. Not that we don't trust the individual individually, but it's always better to prevent any accusations of any kind of financial mismanagement or underhanded fraud or anything like that. We want to have two people who have their hands on the money, or at least their eyes on the money, as much as possible. I think I mentioned some other time, a couple of years ago, some unknown person, a guy who I'd never seen before, and frankly, I've never seen him again. He came to my office one day and asked if we support missionaries. And I said, yes, we have about 10 or 12 missionaries. I told him about our missionary prayer board back there and the newsletters that we get. Yes, we support a number of missionaries. And he said, well, I really like to support missionaries, and I think what they're doing is good. And so he handed me $1,000. If I remember right, it was $1,000 in cash. And said, here, make sure this gets to the missionaries. Well, I'm by myself in the office, I think, you know, regular daytime, you know, midweek. I forget what day of the week it was. But this guy gives me $1,000 and leaves all by myself. And I think to myself, ha, 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 I've got $1,000. Ooh, what could I do? Well, no, I thought to myself, oh, no, I got to get rid of this money. So almost immediately I went to the bank and put it in the bank. I didn't want to have $1,000, not, you know, that I'd be tempted to spend that on, you know, Dairy Queen and Culver's and blueberries and things like that. But I thought, I don't want accusations. I'm going to tell the church that somebody gave me $1,000 in cash, but I'm not going to say, and it sat on my desk or in my desk drawer for the next week. I deposited it right away because I don't want to have the responsibility of having that money in my hands, myself, all by myself alone. And generally speaking, I don't handle the money of the church. I mean, I spend the money of the church. I have a credit card, and occasionally we need to buy things, and I can do that. But I don't spend money. I mean, I have a limit on how much I can spend just myself. And I don't, you know, look at the offerings. I don't know how much people are giving. That the deacons and the others in the church regulate a lot of that stuff. So I think it's important when we're dealing with financial things to have more than one person who is accountable for those things. And then verse 21, providing honorable things, not only in the sight of the Lord, but also in the sight of men. So another thing that we can do is act honorably, both in the sight of God and the sight of men. He says, providing honorable things. This word providing means using forethought, thinking ahead, planning ahead, and making provision for something. So he's planning ahead. This is all going according to a well-thought-out plan. And just like everything else in the church, it should be done in an orderly way. Let everything be done decently and in order. So this is not just sort of shooting from the hip. This is not just off the cuff. This is something's planned. This whole offering, this whole collection of this offering for the poor saints in Jerusalem, this is going according to plan. And so he wants to make sure that this is done in a proper and an organized way. But the most important thing here, making sure that it is, as he says here, honorable in the sight of the Lord. That's a very important thing, that we're making sure that we're doing things properly from God's perspective. Not only that, you know, we think it's the right thing to do, but we think that it's what God would want for us as well. In verse 19, administered by us for or to the glory of the Lord himself. Honorable in God's sight. So the primary thing that we have to consider is the glory of God. What would God want? How can we operate the church for the glory of God and in a way that would be creditable for Him? Somebody said, we glorify God by using what He gives us the way that He wants it used. If the people who manage church finances are not aiming to glorify God, well, then they'll soon be using those funds in a way that dishonors God. And you don't have to look far among churches today to see that they use money in a way that dishonors God. There's lots of things, lots of shenanigans and things that go on in churches today that are costly. They're using the funds of those people who are giving toward that ministry, and they're using them in ways that are frankly dishonoring to God, and that's a shame. We have to be careful. Those who are managing the money have to have that overall desire that they're operating for the glory of God. They're not doing it for themselves. They're not doing it for the glory that they might accrue for themselves. They're doing it for God. Over in Exodus 18, Jethro's advice to Moses. You may remember that Moses was sitting all day judging the people, and Jethro, his father-in-law, comes and gives him this advice. He says, moreover, you shall select from all the people able men, such as fear God, men of truth, those who hate covetousness, and place them to be the rulers. So this is what we need in the church as well. People who are able, who fear God, men of truth, and hate covetousness. That's the kind of people who need to be in charge of the funds, of the counting the funds and depositing the funds and collecting the offerings. These are the kinds of people that we need. So we do things honorable in the sight of the Lord, people who have the glory of God foremost in their mind, but then also in the sight of men. At the end of verse 21, honorable things not only in the sight of the Lord, but also in the sight of men. So it's important that people see that we're doing things honorably and honestly. We should strive to be above reproach and blameless in all areas, especially when dealing with money and financial matters. So we want to maintain a good reputation, and that's what I mean. If someone were to say, who's an honorable, honest, reliable, trustworthy person? Let's put them in charge of this financial thing. Well, who do we think of? Hopefully all of us would have those virtues of being trustworthy and honest and reliable, that anybody could give you some money and say, here, take care of this, you know, for this project or for this fund or whatever. All of us should strive to do things honorably in the sight of God and man. Our main aim is to glorify God, but also to maintain a good reputation. And so if we have these goals, if we put God first and God's glory first, well, then we don't worry about financial mismanagement, because people who honor and glorify God are not involved and not guilty of financial mismanagement or abuse. The greater our responsibility, the greater our need to do things honestly and honorably. All right, so let's go on then to the second or the last of these virtues that he mentions in verse 23. He says, if anyone inquires about Titus, he is my partner and fellow worker concerning you. Or if our brethren are inquired about, they are messengers of the churches to the glory of Christ. So cooperative partnership is how I've described this. Another virtue, another way that we can make sure that we are serving and honoring God in the proper way is to participate in cooperative partnership. Paul is trying to show that these men who he sent to collect this offering are qualified, worthy, and honest people. Paul calls Titus here his partner and fellow worker. The word partner is based on the same word as fellowship. It's koinonia. You've maybe heard that word before. It's based on the word common, what we have in common. So being a partner is somebody who is linked together in a common goal. And so Titus and Paul are fellow workers. They're partners together. In fact, Titus is the only one that Paul calls a partner in ministry. Now, Paul had a lot of different colleagues. He had a lot of others that he worked with in doing various things, but Titus is the only one that he mentions as a partner. Titus and Paul must have enjoyed a very close personal relationship of trust and confidence. You can imagine the blessing of having the great apostle Paul say that you are his partner. And so that's what Titus was. He said he is very much like me in his care and his earnest desire for you. And then he uses the word fellow worker, a person engaged in the same work. Titus, of course, had worked with Paul for a long time. They had many experiences together as they served in gospel ministry. You might say that Titus was a team player. He worked together with Paul and with these other colleagues. Serving together with partners and fellow workers is a wonderful experience. I don't know how much experience you've had in serving with other people, people of like mind, people who are trying to do the same job. Serving together with these kinds of people is a real blessing and a benefit. Years ago, I had a person like this, somebody that I would call my partner and fellow worker in the ministry. And some of you have heard this name before, Scott Estelle. He's a fellow who's really a solid Bible teacher, and I've used some of his materials before. Scott and I went to school at Maranatha together all 4 years, actually 6 years at Maranatha together, and then we both went to Detroit Seminary together. And I remember the day that I was in Detroit, or in the suburbs of Detroit, looking for an apartment. I just got there. I was going to start seminary in the next couple of weeks. So I was trying to secure an apartment. And I had just been into this one apartment complex, looking at various apartments to see if one was available. And I forget exactly the details now, but I think I was driving into this apartment complex, and Scott, my friend, was driving out. And we stopped and waved at each other. I knew that he was going to be going to school in Detroit Seminary, but I didn't have any idea where he'd be living or anything. And so it just turns out that we met each other at this apartment complex. He said that they had just moved in, and I said that I was looking at that apartment complex. And he said, guess what? There's an apartment open right across the hallway from us. So I quickly turned in and went and talked to the lady and secured that apartment right across the hallway from Scott and his wife, Cindy. Cindy can make some tremendous chocolate chip cookies. If you ever run across them, ask for the recipe for their chocolate chip cookies, because we enjoyed those cookies for the next couple of years as we worked together. Scott and I were both going to school together with several other people from that region, and so we got to know each other really well and traveling back and forth to school. And then we worked on curriculum together. He eventually became the youth pastor of a church in Flat Rock, Michigan, which is about 5 miles away from where I was in Gibraltar. And so we cooperated and worked together in numbers of things, curriculum development. We had youth group activities together. We even took a missions trip to Canada one time together with our two youth groups. So if I think of somebody who is my partner and fellow worker, frankly, one of my best friends in the ministry that I still keep up with today, it's Scott Estelle. And it's been a wonderful, enriching experience working together with somebody like that. So would anyone describe you as a partner or a fellow worker in the work of the Lord? You know, when you think of partner and fellow worker, who do you think of? Who works with you in partnership in the work of the Lord? Well, maybe nobody comes to your mind. Maybe you are one of the people who are partnering and fellow worker in the work of the Lord. But perhaps you're not. Perhaps you're not a partner with anybody. Maybe you're a partner in work, let's say in your business or your career. You may be a partner in your family, obviously. Maybe you're a partner in recreation. Maybe you're on a team of some sort and you play sports or whatever. You're a good fellow worker and a partner in many other aspects. But what about in the work of the Lord? Is there anybody who would say, yes, that is my partner in God's work? That is my fellow laborer in the harvest field of the Lord? Well, I think each one of us ought to strive to be a person like Titus as a partner and fellow worker. We can't do the work of the Lord ourselves, all just by ourselves. We have to partner with others. We have to serve with others. And so hopefully all of us are engaged in some means, in some way, of serving with others in the work of the Lord. Do others even want to work together with you? Some people have a reputation for being hard to work with. I hope that that doesn't describe you. You know, there are people who are kind of prickly and kind of difficult. And if given the opportunity, I'd rather not work with this person, because every time I do, there's a conflict, there's a problem, there's some blow up that happens because this person is hard to work with. Well, I get the sense that Titus was not like that at all. You might say he was easy to work with. And that's the kind of people that we want to be as well, easy to work with. People who want to work with us. Let's see, I've got a project to do. Who can I call to help me with this project? Oh, I know. This person is very honest and reliable, trustworthy, and easy to work with. Well, that's what we want to be, easy to work with, not hard to work with. We want to be the kind of person who can be that fellow worker and partner in the ministry. He also calls these colleagues our brethren and messengers of the churches. In fact, this word messenger is kind of interesting because it's actually in the original language, apostoli, the apostles. The word apostle here is used of these messengers. Now, how in the world are these people apostles? Well, in a kind of a generic sense, an apostle is just someone who's sent out. If you're sent out for the work of the ministry, you are an apostle. Of course, the word apostle can be used in various ways. Apostles are the 12 original apostles, the 12 original disciples, the followers of Christ. And they, to have that position as one of the original disciples or apostles, you had to have been with Christ and seen him after the resurrection. So that only pertained to just that small group of people. Paul is later called an apostle. Jesus appeared to him on the road to Damascus. He became known as the apostle to the Gentiles. But the word apostle can be used more generically or more broadly of almost anybody who is serving the Lord, serving the church, sent out on the Great Commission. We might even think of missionaries as apostles because they are commissioned and sent out by the church to do the work of the ministry, to bring the gospel to those who haven't heard. And really, all of us, all believers, are apostles in the sense that we are sent out with a great commission to go into all the world, to preach the gospel, to make disciples of all nations. Well, these are the messengers or representatives sent out by the church for this specific task. They're messengers of the churches, accountable to the churches. The churches had appointed them and expected to do this job faithfully. Well, anyone in serving the church should see themselves as accountable. We are accountable to the other members of the church. As we serve the Lord as whatever it is, a Sunday school teacher, an usher, a musician, whatever we're doing, we should recognize that our accountability is to the rest of the body of Christ that we're serving. We're accountable to the people in the church. We believe that the church is God's program for today. The local church is what God is doing. Since the beginning of the local church in Acts chapter 2, how is God working in the world? Well, primarily through the local church. And it's sort of sad to me that there are so many people who think of themselves as serving God in some way or another, but they're not doing it in relationship or under the accountability of a local church. They're just sort of like lone wolf Christians, often doing good things, but they're not accountable to a local church. Well, the only institution that God developed or that God began, Jesus said, I will build my church. There's nothing about radio stations. There's nothing about universities. There's nothing about hospitals. As good as those institutions are, they're not the local church. God has put his stamp of approval on the local church. And I believe that virtually all ministry, almost all ministry at least, should be done in connection with or in accountability to a local church somewhere. So I think that's a good thing because then you've got a group of people who hold you accountable for what you're doing in the ministry. And you tend to stay orthodox better if you have accountability to a local church. Well, notice again, verse 23 at the very end, he says, if our brethren are inquired about, they are messengers of the churches, the glory of Christ. Interesting grammatical thing here. They are messengers of the churches, the glory of Christ. In other words, they're serving honorably. They're bringing glory to God through this service. And so, again, we see the importance of the glory of God as the primary motivation. Why are we serving God? Why are we involved? Because we want to bring glory and honor to Christ. 1 Corinthians 10:13, whether therefore you eat or drink or whatsoever you do, do all for the glory of God. So if you're serving in any kind of capacity within the church, the highest goal or aim has to be to bring glory and honor to God. So Christian ministry requires cooperative partnership. The more people are involved in the ministry, the more we can do. We have, for example, the spring work day coming up. And we all know that if we have a bunch of projects to do around the church, many hands make light work. So let's say, for example, a certain pastor had a big, heavy thing to move. Let's say a piano. And let's say the pastor asked for several people to help out with moving this piano. And then a lot of people could say, yes, I will help and move this piano. And that would make light work for everybody, wouldn't it? Well, it just so happens we are getting a piano, a used piano, and we'll hopefully have it moved. We were going to try to do it today because of the rain and things, we decided not to. But eventually, the door will open for people to help in moving this piano, and then many hands will make light work, hopefully, and that'll be wonderful. So opportunities to be involved in cooperative partnership. I hope that anyone, if anyone were describing any one of us, they'd be able to say something like what we find in verse 23. Partner, fellow worker, messengers of the churches for the glory of Christ. Wouldn't it be wonderful if someone would think of you or me in those terms? Let's say the epitaph on our tombstone. They are messengers of the churches, the glory of Christ. My partner and fellow worker. Boy, those are high terms of virtue. If someone could ever look at us and say, they're partners, fellow workers, they're serving the churches for the glory of Christ, that's about as high as you can get. I mean, that's the highest goal that you can set for yourself, is to serve the church for the glory of Christ. And so I hope that all of us would seek to have those qualities evident in our lives. And let me once again put in a plug for vocational ministry. Some people perhaps today, some people here today, in the future, could pursue vocational Christian ministry and do it like it says here in verse 23, a partner, fellow worker with others, messengers of the churches for the glory of Christ. I think that is a very wonderful thing to devote your adult life to do. To say, my life is going to be oriented and devoted to serving God through the church. To serve the churches for the glory of Christ. That's going to be my high goal and motivation. That's going to be what I'm going to dedicate my life to do. To serve the church, the glory of Christ. And do it in a way that we can be partners with others and serve together. So that's, to me, that's a wonderful thing. And perhaps there are some young people here today who would say, yes, that's what I want to do with my life as well. To devote my life to serving the church for the glory of Christ. Well, we have the final verse here, 24. Therefore, show to them and before the churches the proof of your love and of our boasting on your behalf. So he's talked about these men. They've shown up with this letter. They're there to arrange for and ultimately collect this offering. He says that they're trustworthy, honest people. Therefore, he says, essentially, treat them right. Do right by these men. These men are here to collect this offering. They're honest, reliable people. Make sure that you treat them right. And he says, demonstrate your love. This word show to them, verse 24. And the proof, the word show and proof are actually based on the same root word, which means to demonstrate, to show, to give evidence of something. And so show them, he says, your love. Probably speaking of love for God, love for Paul, love for the gospel, love for the church. Show them your love. Show them that you care about these men and that they're doing a good thing. You know, we don't have apostolic messengers like this. These were the messengers that Paul sent to collect this offering. Do we have people like that coming to our church? Well, not really. But we do have apostles in kind of the lowercase a sense of missionaries. We have missionaries who come here from time to time. They're sent out by the churches to do the work of the gospel ministry. And we ought to show them love. Love for them, love for the work, love for the gospel, love for the church, love for the mission that they're going to. We usually have a love offering for the missionaries as they come through here. So we can demonstrate love and care and concern for these missionaries because we love what they're doing. We appreciate them. We want to support them as much as we can. And obviously we can't support all of them, but when they come through here, we can show them love and concern. Paul talks about boasting about them. Of course, he had boasted to the Macedonians that the Corinthians were interested in this offering. And one of the reasons that the Macedonians wanted to give was because they heard that the Corinthians were going to give. And so he says, don't let this boasting be in vain. Make sure that, you know, I'm kind of bragging on you as a good church who's going to contribute to this offering. And so I hope that I can continue to do that. He does this in the face of, or he says, before the churches, meaning that, again, each church is kind of interrelated to the other churches. We have the privilege of being part of the Wisconsin Fellowship of Baptist Churches. These are about 100 or so like-minded churches and pastors in the state who are essentially trying to do the same thing. Our churches are very similar to one another, and we're basically trying to pursue the Great Commission and do the Lord's work. And we hope that we have a good relationship, and I think we do have a good relationship with these other churches. I don't know that any of the other churches are boasting about themselves, or we don't think that anybody is bragging on us. But we certainly want to maintain a good reputation and a good relationship with all the other churches that are part of our fellowship. And really, we would hope that we would have a good reputation among all the churches. You may remember that we hosted here, the Wisconsin Fellowship of Baptist Churches Pastors and Wives Fellowship. There were 60 or so, 70 people, something like that, here for that. And many of you helped and cooperated with hosting that event. And it went really well, and I got some good comments about the church and the facilities and how everything was hosted. And so, you know, that to me is a good way of developing a good reputation with the other churches. Not that we're trying to brag about ourselves or anything, but we do want to maintain a good reputation. We want to do things in an exemplary way. I think we want, if we have association with other churches, we have meetings here or anything, we want to do things in a proper and a good way to to demonstrate that we're doing things properly and rightly here. So I think it is a good thing that we try to develop and maintain a good reputation among the churches. And so putting all this together, what qualities should we look for in those who serve in the ministries of the church? Well, there's diligence that he mentions, an eager and earnest care for others. There's the approval of the church. Our aim should be to provide a beneficial service for the church. We see ourselves as servants of the church. We're doing this Sunday school, vacation Bible school, nursery, whatever we're doing it for the benefit of the people in our church, and we're doing it approved by them. Faithful administration. We should be taking care of our responsibilities. Whatever it is that we have that we are responsible for, we want to be diligent. We want to be very careful about what we're doing. Honest financial operations. Doing things honorably in God's sight and in the sight of others as well. We're not liable to accusations or allegations about fraud or mismanagement. And then cooperative partnership, able to work together with others for the benefit of the church and for the glory of Christ. And so when the church has people like this, with these kind of virtues, it stands as an example then to other churches and is worthy of praise. When we have people with these virtues serving, well, that automatically makes us a church with a good reputation. Well, I wonder what people say about us. Would anybody describe us in this way as they're thinking about you or me? Would they say his or her praise is in the gospel throughout all the churches? Would they use words like diligent and honest and faithful to describe our service for the Lord and for the church? Do we work together with others for the glory of Christ and the benefit of the church? Are we good administrators of the church's resources? Are we doing our work diligently and with care? These are the qualities toward which all of us should aspire. Well, let's close in prayer.